So there's a lot of EHT activity around here. So I assume that most of you have seen an EHT talk before. Is that, how many of you have seen way too many EHT talks? Okay. Well, I'm not going to assume that you know everything about EHT, so I'm sorry. I'll have to give a little introduction. So I'm going to describe some new work that's trying to anticipate what EHT is going to see in the future and what we can do with it. And this is work I've done with my graduate student, Nick Conroy, and I've somehow forgot to put his name up here, my postdoc, Miki Baubach, and then some other students, and then two locals. So Boris was involved in this, as was Avery. Okay, so I have three parts to the talk, and I'm going to start with a review of EHT, what it is, how measurements are made, and then I'm going to talk about what EHT might see in the future in the way of something that we'll describe as a pattern speed, so the speed of rotation of fluctuations on the image. And if I have time at the end, I'll go to a third part, which describes new work on pitch angles of features in EHT images. Okay, so I think people have seen this before. I have to take the hockey stick. So two EHT images out now. This is the one from 2019. This shows the black hole at the center of the galaxy M87, which is a nearby giant elliptical with a supermassive black hole at the middle with a mass of almost 10 billion solar masses. So this is the first one, which was relatively easy to image for reasons that I'll explain in a moment. And then this is the one that came out last year. This is an image of the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is substantially less massive, so only about 4 million solar masses, but significantly closer. And so its apparent size on the sky is actually larger than that of the black hole in M87, but more difficult to image for several reasons that I'll get to a little bit later. Okay, so this one is, you know, something like a factor of 10 to the 3 more massive than this one. The angular size of these images of the projection of the black hole on the sky is related to the, you know, the gravitational radius divided by the distance. This one is more massive but further away, and so this is about 3.8 microarcseconds, or I think this translates into some number of like 15 picoradians, okay, maybe 20. And then the galactic center is a little bit bigger. And then one of the key features of these is that the time scales associated with each source are vastly different. So the black hole in M87 is massive, comparable to the size of the solar system. And so it evolves very, very slowly. The plasma around the black hole, which is producing the light that we actually see with the Event Horizon Telescope, changes very, very slowly. Whereas in the, so the characteristic time scale is light crossing time for RG, which is 9 hours. For the galactic center, the characteristic time scale is only about 20 seconds. So it changes very quickly as we observe it. So what you're actually seeing in these images is obviously not light from the black hole. It's light from the hot plasma around the black hole. And one way of thinking about this is without any relativity involved at all, it's what you would see if you had a perfectly absorbing sphere surrounded by flame. So it actually looks rather like a picture of a torch. So you see a little bit of emission from in front of that perfectly absorbing sphere, and then you see sort of edge-brightened emission from around the edge. And then the gas that's producing the emission has an emissivity which drops off very steeply with radius, with distance from the hole, and so you see very little emission from further out at these wavelengths. The wavelength that this observation is taken at is 1.3 millimeters, frequency of 230 gigahertz. And this is the sweet spot for doing these observations because it's a wavelength that we can see through the Earth's atmosphere. If you go to much shorter wavelength, you run into opacity problems with the Earth's atmosphere. But it's a short enough wavelength that we can actually resolve the source. So the instrument that makes these observations, which is this network of radio telescopes, has an angular resolution, which is sort of diffraction limited. It's the wavelength divided by the size of the instrument, and the size of the instrument is the diameter of the Earth. So you have telescopes on opposite sides of the Earth. And that's what gives the characteristic blurring of these images. Okay, yes, I should also say that the hot plasma that's producing this emission is radiating due to the synchrotron process. So this is a magnetized plasma, magnetic field strengths of order a few tens of Gauss, and it contains electrons with characteristic Lorentz factors of order a few tens or maybe a few hundreds. And that's just perfectly arranged to produce emission in the millimeter band. Okay. So to recap a little bit of the way that these observations are made, the Event Horizon Telescope uses a network of millimeter telescopes, including in this image, which is taken from the point of view of the center of our galaxy, the South Pole Telescope. Is anybody involved in SPT here? Really? Okay. I'm used to being in rooms where half the people are involved in SPT at University of Illinois. Okay, so South Pole Telescope was one of the participating antennas. And then we can make an image by correlating signals between pairs of telescopes and between triples of telescopes, actually. And those give us information about the Fourier components of the image on the sky. And in this particular animation, which is very, very nice in explaining this, very, very helpful, we get an image of a teapot on the right, so something like Russell's teapot. And you can see that as the Earth turns, the baselines move on the sky, and that helps us fill in the Fourier amplitudes in the Fourier plane. And this process is known as Earth rotation aperture synthesis. Okay, so you can get a relatively densely sampled Fourier domain if you can image the source over the course of an entire day as your baselines move across the sky. Okay. Right, so back to the image. Again, the resolution of this is set by the size of the Earth and the wavelength that you observe at. Okay, so we have models of these sources, and there are lots of different kinds of models. Some are analytic. My personal interest is in numerical models of these sources that try and characterize the turbulence in the plasma around the black holes. This is going to show you movies of some of these models for both M87 on the left and Sagittarius A star on the right. Okay, so the models are fluid dynamical models. So we have a fixed metric that describes the black hole, Kerr metric. And then in that metric, we have an ideal fluid that accretes onto the black hole. And some is ejected out the, some plasma can be ejected out the axis. Once we run the ideal fluid simulations, we make images of them. So we assign emissivity and absorptivity coefficients to the plasma through various, we think, well-motivated models. And then we do a radiative transfer calculation where we solve the transfer equation along geodesics, backward along geodesics through the source. And that produces a synthetic image of the source. Okay, so I should also say that in this image, it's a little bit clearer what's going on. So you can see a very bright narrow ring in these images. And that corresponds to what is known as the critical curve or photon ring. And then the in the interior of that critical curve, in the interior of the critical curve, the lines of sight end on the event horizon. Okay, and then just past that, the lines of sight go and right at the critical curve, they land on the photon orbit and circle the black hole. But the set of geodesics on the image that do that is vanishingly small. Okay, so let me turn this on and you can see what we imagine these things look like. Okay, so the image on the right is Sagittarius A star, the galactic center black hole, and the image on the left is M87. And you can see the M87 image is actually evolving if you watch it carefully, but it's evolving very, very slowly. Okay, so this shows the time scale over which it's evolving. And over the course of a single night, you can see that M87 changes hardly at all. And so we can use Earth rotation aperture synthesis to make a fairly accurate reconstruction of the image. So we can fill in the UV plane, the Fourier domain, quite well. For Sagittarius A star, the source is changing as we observe it. And so we can't use Earth rotation aperture synthesis. And so the collaboration developed techniques to try and guess what the average image looks like. Okay, now I also want to say,
So many days, or is it just like one?
So typically it would be on source for Sagittarius A star for, let's say, between 3 and maybe 8 hours over the course of a single night, and then a campaign lasts for maybe a couple of weeks, and you pick out the days during those weeks when there's good weather at most of the sites. Yeah.
So if you time average this, then what you measure, I guess, will be like the time average.
Yeah, something like a time averaged image, yeah.
You mean you construct the image every couple of weeks?
There's a campaign. So EHT operates in campaigns when it can get time on all the telescopes, and the campaigns last about 2 weeks. And then this reconstruction is based on selected data from a single campaign. Okay.
How many times have you reconstructed the image? Because we always see the one that came out in the paper.
Yeah. So there's only published images from one campaign, which is the 2017 campaign. There is data that is being analyzed now from other campaigns, 2018, 2021, and 2022. And there will be published reconstructions of that as well. So let me also say a word about the role of images here. I mean, it's basically for publicity purposes, right? The image is a non-unique representation of the data. So we don't have information about all the Fourier components in the source. And so from sparsely sampled Fourier domain data, we try and reconstruct the best possible guess at the image using various regularization techniques. Okay, but if you're gonna compare it to a model, you don't wanna do it in image space. You want to do it using the what's called the visibility data, the amplitude of the correlations between pairs of telescopes, or other data. Yeah. Okay. Right. So these are the models, and the models work fairly well. So for M87, we have a set of models that match everything we think we know about the source. For the galactic center, we can match all of the EHT data. We can match data taken at other wavelengths for the source. But we have a problem there with the source being less variable than all of the models that fit the rest of the data. So there's something of an inconsistency in the models. They're about a factor of two variable in comparison to the data. Okay. So I just want to go on and give a little bit of context, astrophysical context, for these sources. So this shows a Hubble image of M87. So if you don't know, M87 is the archetypal jet source. It's had a feature in the image that was discovered more than 100 years ago. And this is a jet that exhibits superluminal motion that seems to originate from the center of the galaxy. And these jets are fairly common and can be seen from the other side of the universe, these extragalactic radio jets. So that's M87. Our galaxy, this is our galaxy, the Milky Way, and then you can see in here, somewhere in here, is the black hole at the center of the galaxy. This is the closest supermassive black hole, and it's extremely intensively studied. So most of you probably know that Gensel and Gaze won the Nobel Prize for studies of this source. They were able to track with infrared observations the orbits of individual stars around the central black hole at somewhere between maybe 2,000 and 10,000 gravitational radii from the black hole. And they can follow those orbits. They can measure the radial velocity of the individual stars. And from that, you can infer quite accurately what the mass of the central black hole is and what the distance to the central black hole is. And these are they're inconsistent measurements from the Gaze group and the Gensel group for those numbers, but they're inconsistent at sort of the percent level, which is larger than their error bars, but still a remarkably accurate mass and distance for almost any astrophysical source. Okay. So basically, we know the distance and to the galactic center black hole and the mass to about 1%. And we actually know the ratio of the mass to the distance more accurately, significantly more accurately, to a fraction of a percent. So the ratio of the mass to the distance determines the size of that photon ring on the sky. So we have a very precise prediction from the Gensel-Gaze work of what that should be. Okay, so what did we learn from all this stuff? This is just a selected highlights. We learned a lot of stuff from the EHT images. One of the first things to emerge was an accurate measurement of the mass of the black hole in M87, which prior to this measurement, prior to the EHT images, was uncertain to about a factor of two. So there were one set of measurements that said the black hole mass is about 3 billion solar masses, and there were a separate set of measurements that said it was about 6 billion solar masses. And if it had been 3 billion solar masses, EHT would not have been able to resolve the photon ring as it did. Okay, so that was interesting. In the galactic center, we're able to measure the black hole mass to an accuracy of something like 20%. And that's consistent with the very, very accurate Gensel and Gaze measurements. So in some ways, that's interesting because Gensel and Gaze probe the potential at sort of 2,000 GM over C squared and out. And this tells you that there isn't much mass in between the event horizon and the stars that are observed by Gensel and Gaze. Okay. The next item here is that this confirmed, these observations confirmed the existence of a black hole at the base of M87's jet. So it had long been thought that there was a black hole in there. There were measurements of stellar motions that were consistent with that. But it's a different thing to see the shadow of the black hole in an image. And this is consistent with a hypothesis that the jet is driven by something called the Blanford-Snayak effect. So Blanford-Snayak effect uses magnetic fields that thread the event horizon of a rotating black hole to extract rotation energy from the hole and to power the jet. And this is an idea that goes back to the 1970s with Blanford and Snayak. So you know, if you regard this as a hypothesis, what are the predictions of this model? One prediction is that there's a black hole at the base of the jet. Another prediction is that the black hole is spinning. And there isn't a clear measurement of spin yet for this black hole, but that's something that we would be interested in doing in the future. Okay. So these are fairly model independent statements. So they don't rely on our fluid dynamical models being accurate. But if you believe in the models and you lay down a universe of these fluid dynamical models and do comparisons between the models and the data and try and extract parameters in this parameter space, which consists of spin of the black hole, magnetization of the accretion flow. So there are families of models which are strongly magnetized in the sense that the magnetic field is strong enough to push back on the surrounding, on the accreting plasma and prevent accretion. It also depends on inclination of the black hole and the angular momentum, orbital angular momentum of the accretion flow. And then it depends on parameters that are used to describe the distribution function of electrons, which describes how the plasma radiates. So that those parameters allow us to relate the density and temperature that we observe in the fluid models to radiative coefficients. Okay, so in this parameter space, the magnetically dominated or so-called MAD models, magnetically arrested disk models, are favored. So the in contrast, the weakly magnetized models don't really work in either source. In M87, the asymmetry in the image tells us something about what direction the black hole spin vector is pointing. And it's consistent with the spin vector pointing away from the Earth. In the galactic center, we can rule out models in this parameter space, in this space of models, that have nearly edge-on orientation. So where the orbital angular momentum vector of the plasma is nearly perpendicular to the line of sight. And then finally, we find that there's a problem with the models, that they are quieter, that the models are noisier. The models are noisier than the data. Yeah.
So when you say that you rule out edge-on, then that means that, you know, like, does that mean that you also rule out like spherical flows? The flow has to be a disk.
Yeah, so in this universe of models, all of the models are have approximately circular flow at maybe 10 or 20 gravitational radii. We also, some of you may know Sean Ressler up at CETA now. So Sean and Elliot Quadiert and others built models that explicitly follow the gas from the stars that are orbiting the black hole, the Gensel-Gaze S stars. They follow the gas from stellar winds all the way down to the black hole, which is an impressive calculation. And those look almost exactly like our models. They're not really distinguishable at this point. But they're much less well circularized close to the horizon. So you have episodic, sometimes near radial flow in those models. Yeah.
So what is the data that tells you like it is pointing away from you, like it's up towards you?
Right, so it's the asymmetry in the image. Okay, so I can say a few words about this. So you can see that there's a bright spot. It's brighter on this side than over here on this image. And that's real. We have a well-sampled Fourier domain for this image. And so we have real constraints on the asymmetry of the ring in this case. And it turns out that this follows the spin of the black hole rather than the orbital direction of the material that's accreting. That was something of a surprise when we put these models together for the first time. And so one way to think about it is that there is some of the emitting plasma that's dragged by the rotation of the black hole. And so, I mean, there's a bit of geometry here. Let me get my hockey stick again. So the large scale jet comes out like about this. Okay, and in all our models, we assume that this is sort of the average axis of symmetry of the system. So this jet comes out actually more like this at about 20 degrees to the line of sight. Okay, so if there's plasma circulating around this axis of, associated with the large scale jet, then if it circulates this way, then it's approaching us down here and receding from us up here. And so Doppler boosting then makes it brighter on the bottom. Now that's part of the story. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that because you have to follow the, it's more complicated than that. But that's what gives us information about the spin. Over here, you see this thing that looks like the Ubuntu logo. And this reconstruction is done time averaging, but without Earth rotation aperture synthesis. And as a result, you can't really believe the bright spots in the ring. So those are, the collaboration is very open about this. You can read the imaging paper. They give a set of images that are consistent with the data, and some of them have bright spots located elsewhere around the ring. But you can see, so what you should believe in this is that there is a ring, and you should believe the measurement of the ring diameter. Okay. Yeah, well, and then Lewis, yeah.
So do you need a certain amount of spin to give you this observed asymmetry? Like, is there some constraint on the magnitude of the spin?
So if you, yes. Again, there's a complex variation of the asymmetry with the spin. What happens is that the asymmetry begins to go away at slightly negative spin, and meaning if you consider a source and you with spin vector pointed in this direction, say slightly off the line of sight, and then you reduce the magnitude of the spin, and then you make it point in the other direction. When it begins to point in the other direction, then you the asymmetry vanishes, and then if you go further toward larger spin, pointing the opposite way, then the asymmetry appears on the other side.
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily rule out zero spin.
Yeah, it doesn't null exactly at zero spin. Yeah, but it depends on the geometry of the system, like the inclination of the system. So there's some combination of orbital motion of the plasma and spin of the black hole that enters here. Yeah. Actually, I said Lewis next, and then, yeah.
Yeah, there was a question about the, you said that the models are, the images are quieter than the models. So what's in the models that are setting in shorter time scales? Is it,
yeah, what is it? What assumptions are in the models?
Yeah, so we're very interested in trying to understand what the origin of the amplitude of the variability is. And, you know, this is a whole separate talk, but I can tell you some of the things we're looking at. One is just numerical resolution. So we're now able to do much higher resolution than we did in the original models. Another is missing physics. So the stuff that's accreting here is not a fluid, it's a collisionless plasma. And so you expect corrections, certainly, perhaps substantial corrections to an ideal fluid model. And one thing that we did with Francois Foucart, who you know about this stuff, was develop a sort of Israel Stewart-inspired Brzezinski model. So something that has a little bit of viscosity and a little bit of heat conduction in it. We've developed a numerical implementation of that that we're going to run and see if the viscosity and the heat conduction lower the level of fluctuations. So that's one thing that might be of interest. Yeah, another possibility, by the way, is an observational problem. This would be the best thing of all. When you calculate the variability of the source, what we do, what we measure, is the fractional variability. So we take the variability that we see in single dish or connected element interferometer, low angular resolution images of the source. So that's that tells us what the fluctuations are. And then we try and guess what the flux associated with the compact source is. And that forms the denominator. So if we're getting that wrong, then we're wrong about what the level of fluctuations is in the in Sagittarius A star. And in particular, if we overestimate the compact flux, then it'll look quieter. So that might be part of the problem. Okay. Oh, yeah, you had a question. Yeah, I'm sorry.
To what extent do you know that the jet should follow the black hole span axis?
Yeah.
Because with the accretion flow and the at large scales, I don't know if we're expected to wander.
Yeah, it might wander. So we don't really know. That's the short answer. So what we would like to do is observe the source with sufficient sensitivity that we can see the emission connecting the ring and the jet itself, and then we would know. But certainly there are examples in other systems of bent jets. The beam is very light. It's like, at least in the Blanford-Snyak model, it's like a beam of light. Quite plausible that it would get pushed to the side by material around the black hole and wander. Okay. So I just want to mention one more thing about this, and then I should move on to the new stuff. Clearly, I'm not even going to get to part two of this. The models are quite important in this business because if you can constrain the parameters for the models, then you can measure these other things much more accurately. So if you knew exactly which model to compare to, you could probably measure the angular size of the photon ring a factor of two better. So the models tell you where to place the photon ring on the images. And that's how you do that depends on what model you use to calibrate the system. So at the moment, we look at all the models, or almost all the models. But if you narrow things down to a single model, you can do much better here. Okay. So what's next in this business? What have you done for me lately? In the near future, EHT is going to be able to revisit M87 at regular intervals and make a movie of the source. And in addition, for Sagittarius A star, it's going to have more baselines available. So new telescopes will be added to the network. And that means it can produce higher fidelity images at individual instances, and that means that there's the possibility of producing a movie for Sagittarius A star as well. Opinions differ within the collaboration about how practical each of these things is, but I think it's inevitable that this will be done. So what can we learn from the movies when they arrive, besides that there's going to be a big press conference and it'll be a big unveiling? Okay, so there will be repeated images of both sources, practical on a timescale of years, I would say. So there's already significantly more antennas in the network now than there was at the time of the 2017 observations. Okay, and as I said, the movie making differs a little bit for Sagittarius A star and M87. So in M87, you go back every few weeks and make an image over the course of a single observing season. In Sagittarius A star, you try and get as many telescopes looking at the source over a single night as possible. Okay, so what are the observables that you can pull out of these? Well, there's probably lots of things you can look at. I'm going to focus on rotation frequency, and then I can, you know, if people have questions about this, I can tell you about pitch angle. And the question is, what do the models predict? Okay. So let's start with the pattern speed. And the simplest possible model you can make of fluctuations in surface brightness on this photon ring is a so-called hotspot model. So this is widely used. And one imagines a blob of plasma. That's a technical term. A blob radiates, and it moves on a geodesic, at least in some hotspot models. There are more sophisticated hotspot models where it doesn't move on geodesics, but then there are a lot more parameters. Okay, so this thing just circles the black hole, and then presumably we could use the motion of this hotspot to infer something about the potential. We would treat it like a pulsar, you know, orbiting the black hole. Okay, so. Is this what's seen in our fluid models? And the answer to that is not exactly. If this is what's really going on, then we expect the motion of fluctuations around the ring to be at the orbital frequency, somewhere in the radial region that produces most of the emission that we see, which is between maybe 3 and 6 RG. Okay, that's where most of the emission comes from in the models.
Charles?
Yeah.
I'll help you out here. So as you mentioned, these are not fluids, they're collisionless plasma.
Yeah.
So I guess to assume the hotspot model is there moving the geodesic is consistent with this collision. But is this in addition to the fluid?
Well, meaning that the blob doesn't collide with anything else.
That's right.
But something's holding the blob together.
So, but what are you creating a Frankenstein? So, on one hand, you're assuming the fluid or kind of hotspot, and then
I am not creating this Frankenstein. I'm describing it in a deeply prejudicial manner. So I don't know, you know, exactly what the I don't know how to build one of these with a fluid simulation or a collisionless plasma simulation. Yeah. Okay. So what do we see in the simulations? Well, so this is a full resolution image. So this is a, you know, the resolution that's only accessible in our imaginations, without trillions of dollars, in, you know, to build an interferometer in space. And you can see the photon ring here. This is for Sagittarius A star. This is a model that more or less works with the data. And you can see that these fluctuations are sort of spiral waves in the plasma. And they circulate around. And so we might ask, are these things circulating at the orbital speed for the plasma? OK, and I just want to emphasize something, which is that, let's see if I can do this. This is not what you get to observe. So what you get to observe is something more like this. Okay, so most of that detail is hidden away in the beam. But nevertheless, you can see some features here still, even at this low resolution, that are circulating. And, you know, are those moving at the orbital speed of the plasma? So the answer to that is no. Okay, so this little clock hand on here shows you something that's moving at the Keplerian speed somewhere in the emission region. And we've set the orbital frequency equal to 9/10 of the so-called Keplerian frequency. Keplerian here, in this context, means a circular orbit frequency in the equatorial plane. And no one knows why it's called Keplerian. As one of my collaborators says, Kepler left the scene a while ago. But this is the terminology that's used to refer to circular equatorial orbits. Okay, and you can see that this isn't really describing the motion of the fluctuations. And in fact, they seem to be moving substantially slower than this. So how can we measure orbital or frequency of these fluctuations that move around the photon ring? Okay, so we're gonna try and measure the dominant signal here, which is gonna move around the ring at some frequency. And we're gonna call this the pattern speed, omega p, which is it's sort of an angular phase velocity of whatever's causing this these features to appear. Okay, so we've developed a procedure to do this. And what we do is in each image in this movie, we identify a ring. And in the simulations, we know exactly where the ring is, so with great precision. But you don't really need to know exactly where the ring is because the resolution is so bad. So we lay down a ring on the image, and on the smoothed image. And you can see that if you move this a little bit to the left or the right or up or down, we wouldn't find different values for the brightness, surface brightness on the ring, okay?
The silly question, is it that the blob is moving substantially slower? So how do we know we're gonna be victims of aliasing and it's actually gone much too fast? Because it would be violating some causality or something?
Yeah, so that, in interpreting the observations, that's certainly possible. In the models, we're gonna see that it, you know, there's a reason for this. Yeah. I think that answers your, yeah. Okay. We worried about aliasing, and we tested this with a range of, phenomenological models that were rotating at different rates. It's like you can do it on a sped up version of this movie. Okay, so we smooth it. And then we extract the brightness temperature on that ring. Okay, so there's an angular coordinate on the ring here, and then there's a time coordinate here in the movie. Okay, and you can see that these brightest features sort of progress toward larger angle, position angle, over time. So they're tending to move in a particular direction. Is that apparent from this? This may be, there's a slight slope to these things. It's small, yeah. Yeah, okay. So this is the data that we start with. So this is, in this business, it's called a cylinder plot. So we have brightness temperature as a function of position angle and time. And then if you want to look at fluctuations on this, your first impulse is to standardize the data. So what we do is take the log of the brightness temperature and then subtract over at each position angle and at each time. So the mean of the fluctuating log brightness temperature is zero. Okay. So this produces something that looks like this. So now we're using all the information available at every time and every position angle. Okay. And then this thing looks sort of uniform. And so we can measure the slope of these features, which is going to tell us what the pattern speed is, by taking an autocorrelation function. And that gives us something like this. And now we've sort of zoomed in time. So now we actually can see the slope. It's not negligible. And you get an autocorrelation function that looks like this. So the brightness fluctuation at a given position angle is strongly correlated with the brightness correlation seen at an advanced position angle at a later time. So the slope of this thing tells us what the pattern speed is. Okay. So we measure slope. And we have various ways of testing this against a Gaussian random field model and against the simulations. OK. So what you see here is, first of all, the slope measured for this particular model, which is about 1 degree per GM over C cubed. OK, and this shows the frequency that I used in the last clock hand thing, which is the orbital frequency somewhere in the emission region. And that's about 6 degrees per GM over C cubed. OK, so this is kind of the naive Keplerian hotspot model. And this is what we actually see in the simulations. So you see these slowly circulating features moving around the photon ring. So this is a prediction of the models that we will not see rapidly orbiting features, so we'll see only slowly moving features. Okay, yeah.
Can you predict this pattern speed from like the dispersion relation for tidally wound?
You're ahead of me. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. Yeah, I mean, there's information that you need from the simulation to do that, and it's more of a postdiction or an interpretation than a prediction. OK, so here is one of these models with the measured pattern speed. And you can see that we've more or less got the motion of these features correct. We're picking out the dominant orbital frequency of the fluctuations here. There are some features that move a little bit faster if you watch very carefully, and some that move slower. But this is going to be the thing that's easiest to measure, right? So we're working with really difficult data. And I think we're only going to be able to pick out one pattern speed from this. OK. So this is in accord with, this is a sanity check. It looks about right. OK. And again, this shows you the Keplerian orbital frequency against the movie, and you can see it doesn't look like the high resolution movie. And we can then go and show the high resolution movie with the measured pattern speed. And you can see these things kind of move slowly around the photon ring, these spiral features. Okay, I should wind up. Okay, and by the way, we can check that this isn't an artifact of the simulation resolution, so this shows double the resolution in the GRMHD simulation, and the pattern speed measured from that agrees to within a couple percent. Okay, so what's the physical origin of this? So these things look like spiral waves, and that's what they are. They're analogous to the spiral density waves that we see in disk galaxies. Except that self-gravity is not important here. So Thumre's Q is something like 10 to the 33 here. Okay, so there's no self-gravity. And so these are, what we're seeing are ingoing, rotationally modified sound waves, or weak shocks, which are almost the same thing. And again, these are familiar from galactic dynamics. The pattern frequency corresponds to the orbital frequency at the radius where the waves are excited. And so if the pattern frequency is low, that means the waves were excited relatively far from the black hole. And for the pattern frequencies we're measuring in the simulations, it means they're excited out at maybe 15 or 20 RG, GM over C squared. Okay, so so the dispersion relation for these things looks like this. So this is the fluid frame frequency. So it's Doppler shifted from the global frequency into the fluid frame with this factor k dot v. And you can see that this frequency is going to depend on the geometry, because it depends on this thing, which is the square of the epicyclic frequency, which depends on the geometry. And it depends on, for example, the radial velocity, which also depends on the geometry. So if you have a counter-rotating fluid around a spinning black hole, maximally rotating black hole, then it starts to inflow rapidly at 9 gm over c squared. If you have prograde fluid circulating around a maximally rotating black hole, it doesn't start to flow in rapidly until you're almost on the horizon. Okay, so there's geometry dependence here and here, and this is sort of a pseudo-Newtonian calculation. I haven't done the whole relativistic theory here. Okay, but it does depend on the geometry, and so we expect it might depend on spin.
And what's special about 15M?
Right, good. So it turns out that in these models, the mass in the accretion flow increases with radius, at least out to some radius. And there's sort of a feature at about 15 gm over c squared where the slope of the mass with radius changes. So you can think of this as being an acoustic radiator around the black hole at somewhere around that radius. But I think working out a theory of exactly how these waves propagate is a really interesting project, and you know, something that's for the future. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that feature in the mass distribution depend on the initial conditions, like where the pressure max?
Yeah. So that is absolutely something we think not, but that's certainly a risk here. So we haven't been able to check a really wide range of initial conditions. So I think that's still something to worry about. You know, if the mass profile is correct, but the location of that thing is wrong, then it might be located further out and the pattern speed might be even lower. Yeah. Okay, but assuming that we've done this correctly and we've checked appropriately, we can measure the pattern speed as a function of model parameters. And we see that for all of the models, it's of order 1 degree per GM over C cubed. So it depends directly on the mass. So this pattern speed is like a clock. And if we measure the pattern speed, we can potentially use that to constrain the mass. It's not a very good clock. It's a turbulent clock. But you know, at least it has an interesting dependence on that. And then it also depends on spin. So the pattern frequency goes up as the spin goes up. And then it depends on the cosine of the inclination. So if we're looking at the disk from above, stuff goes one way. And if we're looking at it from below, it goes the other way. Okay. So we can, if we can measure at least the sine of this pattern frequency, then we can know which way the accretion flow is circulating around the black hole on the sky, narrow the range of parameter space that we're looking at, and potentially get more information out of the observations. Okay, so I'm gonna wind things up there and just put up this summary. So we can test the models. The models predict slow pattern speeds, sub-Keplerian. We can get the sense of rotation out of the movies. We can check, for example, whether in Sagittarius A star, the EHT source plasma is rotating in the same direction as Gensel et al. Infer from the gravity interferometer measurements. So they see a infrared bright spot, which arises from a process, radiatively from a process, which is slightly different from this. And that seems to circulate around the black hole in a clockwise direction on the sky. So we can check whether that is consistent. And then from relations like the one I just showed you, we can perhaps get constraints on the inclination, mass, and spin of the black hole. So that's it. Thanks.
So any more questions for Charles?
So for your relation for the pattern speed that this depends on spin, so I was just wondering how that like spin correction compares to like the other variability you saw from like varying the initial conditions.
You mean how accurately can we actually measure this?
Yeah,
I think it's not clear yet. So one thing, one shortcut that we took in analyzing this is in doing all the analysis in image space when the data is actually in the Fourier domain. So it's Fourier amplitudes and so-called closure phases, which are correlations between triples of telescopes. And so I think to really understand how accurately the measurement can be done, you need to go dig into that data and see what you can extract. That is my leading concern in terms of errors in this process. Then you might worry about how long a movie you can make. And at least for M87, these are not going to be feature-length films. They're going to be like TikTok videos. And so you know, you can, I could probably count the number of frames in an M87 video without taking my socks off. And so so then the question is, how long a time series do you really need to do this? And we've explored that a little bit in, you know, using our image domain sampling. And it looks like you can get a pretty good estimate. So, you know, the error bars are in the paper, Conroy et al. 2023, with, you know, very brief videos.
You mentioned you didn't have time for the pitch angle, but can you say?
Yeah, I can give you a pitch on that. Yeah. So you can do the same sort of analysis to get the pitch angle. So you can look at brightness fluctuations at one radius and another radius. It's, let's say, further out. And if the emitting features are spirals, then there should be a correlation between the fluctuations at different radii offset slightly in position angle. And so you measure that offset, you measure the peak cross correlation between the brightness fluctuations, and that gives you a pitch angle. And that turns out to be somewhat more sensitive to the spin. So if the black hole is counter-rotating, you can actually, as you move in from outside, you can see the sense of the pitch angle change. You know, it goes from trailing to what seems to be leading as you go inward. Yeah. And by the way, I should say, there's work by Angelo Riccarte, which looks at this, basically the same effect, using polarization measurements and looking at the sort of pitch angle of the polarization vectors as you go in. And that shows a similar thing for extreme counter-rotating black holes. Okay.
Any more questions?
Hi, Charles. This is Weimar. So, just from more like common questions. So, from a model fitting perspective view, can we just fit geometric models to the data to measure the like a rotational dimension model to measure the pattern speed and also the pitch angle? Is it viable?
Right. So what you can imagine is using some kind of RIAF-like model, and then superposing fluctuations on it, and then fitting to those models, which I think is almost the same thing as this. So then the model would be playing a different role in the, you know, in the analysis. I think you would be using it as a measurement tool. You know, you'd be model fitting as a measurement tool. And here, the fluid model actually predicts where the waves are excited and, you know, what the phase velocity of the waves is. And I don't know how you predict that from a phenomenological model. So let me also say that I think you should use the analytic models whenever you can. And I just think that this is not a situation where it's possible to do that other than as a measurement tool. Yeah.
So just a naive question. I was wondering if there are already simulations where black holes are replaced by compact objects and whether there is any difference between them.
Yeah, so Luciano Rizzola's group has looked at accretion in some modified metrics. And we're doing this too. But the sad story of this business is that the changes in the metric that are consistent with existing constraints are really small. And it's really hard to see. So for example, you kind of expect deviations from GR to produce deviations in the metric, which are small compared to the deviation due to spin, right? And we can't measure spin yet. So maybe that's not what you were asking. Maybe you were asking about a...
The point is, the corrections to the metric are suppressed, but perhaps if you have a substantial change, so you do not have an event horizon.
You don't have,
but surface, I was wondering if that...
Yeah, so there's a series of arguments about that in the Sagittarius A star, the Galactic Center series of EHT papers, and there are arguments about what the albedo of the surface can be before you start to see that. And then you got to make up a lot of physics. You know, I mean, if you're going to complain about fluid simulations here, then you really have to worry about plasma that accretes onto a non-radiating but solid object and then produces no radiation. So one way of thinking about this is in terms of constraints on the heat capacity of the object, and all those arguments are made in that